everyone, and welcome back to Carry the One Radio. I'm Nancy, a producer here on the team. Today we are releasing our second episode in collaboration with the UCSF Institute of Global Health Sciences. Although this interview was conducted around October of last year, the themes and topics discussed are still relevant. In this episode, our producer Ben Mansky spoke with Drs. Patience Afellani and Dilys Walker about their paths to global health, the self-explanatory yet missing aspect of person-centered care in our health system, and how the COVID pandemic has worsened but also shed light into its importance. We hope you enjoy.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Could each of you introduce yourself? Here's your name, title, and your affiliations.
So my name is Patience Afellani. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Epi and Biostatistics. I hold a secondary appointment in the Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences Department and affiliated with the Institute for Global Health Sciences and the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health.
I'm Dilys Walker. I'm a professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at UCSF. I'm also at the Institute of Global Health Sciences, where I lead the Global Maternal Newborn Child Health Research Group. And I have an affiliate position at the University of Washington Global Health Sciences and in Mexico at the National Institute for Public Health in Mexico.
Could each of you just give like a few sentence overview of your work? I guess we can start with you again, Patience.
Yeah, sure. So my research is in reproductive, maternal, neonatal, and child health. And I am very much interested in how social and health system factors influence these outcomes, particularly also around disparities and how those produce inequalities. I can speak more to some of the current work I'm doing. Most of my work in the last few years has focused on quality of care during pregnancy and childbirth, especially around the person-centered dimensions of quality.
And me, my work, I think, and in general, the work of the Maternal Newborn Child Health Research Group, we focus a lot on quality of care throughout the reproductive life course and sort of certainly considering the sort of the fact that now about 80% of women are delivering in facilities, it really is focused around facility-based care and different approaches to improving both experience and provision of care.
I would like to hear a little bit about how each of you sort of got to global public health as a discipline.
So I am from Ghana, so maybe I started doing global health before I even knew what global health was. I was trained as a medical doctor in Ghana, and I came to the U.S. to do public health. And so I've always had a deep desire to do things that will improve the health of people back in Ghana. And coming to UCSF sort of gave me the opportunity to go beyond Ghana. So I didn't make like a conscious decision I was going to do global health. It was that I'm doing public health and I want that health to improve. I mean, that's what I'm studying, to improve the health of people in Ghana, which is what global health is. I started from a clinical background, as I mentioned, and as I got to learn more about public health, I was really interested in sort of asking questions and figuring out how to solve it. And so that was what got me into public health.
And for me, the spark for my career in global maternal newborn child reproductive health came when I was a medical student in the 80s. And I took a year off because I had no idea what I wanted to do in medicine. And during that year, I went around the world and I engaged in what is clear when I look back is pretty much medical tourism. I, as a, you know, after my third year medical student, I thought, okay, I'm a clinician. I can go out there and save the world. And it was, you know, pretty quickly in that I realized I was doing nothing to help the world. And I was just getting incredibly rich experience and sort of rude awakening to all sorts of things, including you know, I'll never forget spending the time at the small missionary hospital in Kenya, where I was awoken in the middle of the night and escorted to the maternity ward, because that's what I was sort of drawn towards, to deliver babies. And I sort of thought, are you kidding me? I'm a third year medical student. Am I the one that is taking care of the women on this maternity ward? It just felt crazy to me. And I recognized that, you know, my 3 month stint there wasn't doing anything for those women. And that's where I sort of really became aware that that maternity ward was the, you know, the most poorly resourced, poorly staffed, you know, the conditions were worse than anywhere else in that hospital. And it became a real eye awakening, the disparity of care within whichever setting. And I think that, you know, I like to think that that experience, though I didn't give back then, I'm doing my best to give back now. And I see the value in having done that. You know, women get the short end of the quality stick. And, you know, we need to do what we can to improve that all around the world.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the maternal newborn and child health program at IGHS. Because how long have each of you been involved in it? And I guess what would you describe as the overall mission?
So the Global Maternal Newborn Child Health Research Group came together really out of a need to provide a place for researchers and staff who work in this space to have a sort of a community, a shared experience, a shared sort of objective, which previously didn't exist. I arrived at UCSF in, I guess it was 2013. And I think through the preterm birth initiative investment, it provided an opportunity to really get to know who and where the different researchers are that are working in this space. And we really recognize the need to bring people together and the value that that could have for everybody.
Yeah, and I have been involved since I came to UCSF. Dallas is one of my mentors, so I have been involved in some of her work and have also developed some projects I'm leading under that.
Great. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about that. Patients, you'd mentioned your work on sort of patient-centered care, and I was reading a little bit about some of your research on PCMC, person-centered maternity care. I just wanted to ask sort of how it is that you seek to implement it. What does a patient-centered or a person-centered experience look like?
So I define person-centered maternity care using the Institute of Medicine's definition for patient-centered care, which is basically care that is responsive and respectful of individuals' preferences, needs, and values. And by that definition, it means that we are treating people with dignity and respect within the healthcare system. That involves respecting their privacy, confidentiality, being non-abusive during healthcare setting. It also means communicating effectively with patients, with women in this case, and listening to their experiences and providing care that is supportive, which includes things like allowing them to have a companion of their choice, providing pain medication when they are in labor. So person-centered care focuses a lot on people's experiences in the healthcare system, so how they are treated and how they interact with the healthcare system. One of the aspects of person-centered care, for example, is ensuring privacy and ensuring that women have companions during childbirth. And so this requires that a facility is set up in a way that providers can allow women to have their companions without infringing on their privacy, for example, and also ensuring that they have pain medication to give women in labor. Health systems need to be structured to provide it also, that providers are working within the health system. And so if the health system does not motivate people to provide person-centered care, they are not doing it. And the health system has to also hold people accountable for providing person-centered care.
Yeah, that's something that struck me as patients, as you were talking, was a lot of these aspects of patient-centered care would seem to be on their surface kind of a self-explanatory, like, of course you want this in a provider, but the way that our medical system is structured, it seems, doesn't necessarily or is not conducive to that kind of care, it seems like. Any thoughts about why that is? I don't know.
That's an important point. And it is interesting that you think that these are very self-explanatory. And for the most part, they are. So in some of our work in Kenya, where we interview providers, asking them about whether they provide all the things that we think are under person-centered care, people recognize that these are important things that they need to be doing. But there are a whole layer of other things that prevent them from doing it. And so knowing about person-centered care is just the first step of actually implementing it. So providers, for the most part, know that basic things like introducing yourself to a woman, treating her nicely, communicating to her are important. But they talk about how the system constrains them. So people complain about being so busy, they have little time, and so they don't have time to spend time talking to patients, for example, or the fact that their wards are not set up in a way that they can allow relatives to be in when a woman is laboring. I mean, the medical system is very technical focused, and so people are being trained on the technical aspects. Some of these interpersonal aspects are introduced during training, but once providers start working, the system and the culture within which they work leads them to drop some of those things. My favorite question in all the PCMC things we've started has just been the issue of whether providers introduce themselves to women. And when we talk to providers, they say, these are things we are trained to do in medical school, we're trained to do in nursing school. But when you come to the facility, nobody is doing it. And so we're just doing what everybody else is doing. So that culture within the facility that does not facilitate things that they may know is right for them to do becomes an issue. So my interest in person-centered care started with like an academic question, like why are women not going to give birth in health facilities despite the fact that they have better outcomes? Along the line, it's become a very personal question. Like every time I speak to somebody at home who went to the hospital for something and I ask what happened, it makes me realize how important this work is and how far along we are. I think for me, for this work, my sort of vision for it is that someday when I have to go to the hospital, when a relative of mine has to go to the hospital, we won't be looking for that hospital we know somebody in because we think that is the only way you can receive responsive and respectful care. But we'll get to a point where health systems are set up such that every person, regardless of who you are, regardless of who you know in the health facility or which health facility you go to, can be assured that they will receive care that is responsive to their needs, that is respectful and respects their autonomy and is very supportive of them. So I'll say that's the one thing I want to put to know, that we want to get to that point where we can all receive responsive and respectful care regardless of who we are.
More generally speaking about sort of doing research in global health right now, how has the pandemic sort of altered the kind of work you're able to do in terms of your programs?
And one of the things that has been interesting to see in the data is when you recruit online, you recruit a certain type of people. So the sort of disadvantages of not being able to reach people in person is still there. Other work, it's learning also that our partners in country can do a lot more than sometimes we give them credit for. Now that we all don't have to travel, I mean, we all can't travel, we are sort of comfortable letting people do things, and they are doing it really well. And I think that's one thing that us in global health have to learn, that a lot of our travel sometimes is very unnecessary. We can have our partners in country do a lot of the work that we travel to do. And for me, it's been really interesting seeing what I can do just being here and what I can let other people do in country.
Something that we haven't dug too much into, but I do want to address, is how the advent of COVID-19 and the pandemic has sort of affected a lot of the the conversations around maternal, newborn, and child health. Something that struck me particularly was patients when we were speaking about PCMC, the idea of a companion during labor. A lot of this is about interaction between people, and that's become something of an issue. I guess, are there sort of new approaches to address some of these issues now that COVID-19 is a big public health problem?
Yeah, I think we're still learning a lot about how to adapt to COVID with things like companionship. So certainly COVID has affected maternal and neonatal health seriously. We're still learning about the direct impacts, but we know that even indirectly, maternal outcomes are worsening because of COVID. And some of the things are related to those person-centered dimensions you just mentioned, that women are having poor experiences in the healthcare setting because of things like not being allowed to have a companion. I think in the early phase of the pandemic, a lot of the things that were done were very reactionary and in panic, like banning every companion from labor and those kind of things. And people have sort of adapted in ways to include companions, maybe allowing one person. It might not be the best, but they are doing something rather than just asking every companion to not be present. But in other areas, we've heard stories of neglect. So women going to health facilities in labor and providers not wanting to touch them because of fear of COVID. There are issues of patients, women being sent from one facility to another because no facility wants to receive them. And so all of those things are likely going to introduce the indirect effects of the pandemic, maybe more than we early estimates are showing. We started collecting some data in California here just before the pandemic. And so we're just in the process of analyzing that data. Some of the things we're beginning to look at is things like whether you're treating a dignified manner, whether that has changed, whether companionship changed with the pandemic, whether how people are communicated to change during the pandemic. Unfortunately, I don't have that resource to share with you, but I think those are some of the things we'll see that the pandemic has led to a decrease in person-centered care.
And one thing I would just add, I'm on this advisory group to the DG at WHO, and one of the things we're looking at is COVID, and it's been really interesting over the last 6 months to see the evolution of what we're all talking about from, you know, what are the direct impacts of this new pandemic to what are the indirect impacts and how it's influencing the kinds of things that patients is talking about and how particularly systems are implementing mitigation strategies, whether those mitigation strategies are, you know, centralizing all the COVID patients or changing the way you provide care. And I think what we're beginning to see is that there may be some of these mitigation strategies that may lead to even more patient-centered care and that should actually be maintained. So what does that mean? Maybe it's not right that you have 100 women waiting in a line for their antenatal care visit starting at 7 a.m. And maybe you should be telling people to come in phased out and so that you don't have that density of people because that's not person-centered. Maybe you do need to set up your maternity ward such that two and three women shouldn't be sharing a bed, right? Now, that is totally inappropriate, but COVID may actually be pushing some of these systems to recognize that they actually need to make a change to prevent the spread of COVID when it actually may also be resulting in more person-centered care. And it will be interesting to see as this evolves whether any of those things that may actually be benefits are actually held on to.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the fact that preterm birth remains a really big sort of public health issue worldwide and within the United States as well. Are there things learned that you think could be applied, you know, domestically and elsewhere abroad?
I think that the issue around our domestic preterm birth rates and preterm survival is in some ways very different, in some ways the same. So you know, your global incidence and prevalence of preterm birth is pretty consistent across the world. What is very different is the survival of preterm infants. So in East Africa, a baby born at 28 weeks, if that baby's born alive, it's a live birth. If that baby's born not alive, it's considered an abortion. It's not even considered a birth. Whereas in the United States, a baby that's born at 28 weeks has about a 90% of survival. So there's a lot of issues around access to sort of sophisticated high-tech care, which is a whole nother area. When you talk about the determinants of what causes preterm birth, you know, it's a super complex, multiple things, but certainly at a domestic level, there are a lot of there are many sort of social determinants of preterm birth that are playing an important factor. I think that what is really lacking in sort of this area of maternal newborn child health is, as a global community, taking a responsibility for the fact that women around the world get worse care in whatever setting. If you look at a setting, the women in the maternity ward is worse than anywhere else in that. And, you know, it is something that I've seen everything from here in San Francisco to anywhere else I've worked. And that disparity of care is something we need to address. At the same time, I get, over the years, get more and more frustrated with the amount of investment in new technologies and tools for maternal child health and, you know, this gadget and that gadget, and this is going to transform care, and this pharmacologic agent or this instrument or something that's going to save women's lives and women's babies' lives. That's true. I don't deny that. But there is so much that we know what to do and we can do. And the problem is there's not enough investment in discovering not the what to do, but how you're going to do it. And how do you get systems to reliably and consistently do what they know they have to and need to do? And if we could just get the world to like buy into that, that that's important, we could save a lot of lives.
Thank you all for listening, and we hope you've gained insight into maternal health globally and within the U.S. This episode was produced and edited by Nancy Kai with help from Ifechukwu Okeke and the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. The original interview was conducted by Ben Mansky. Thank you so much to Drs. Patience Afolani and Dilys Walker for their time, and also to the Institute of Global Health Sciences at UCSF for partnering with us. This episode wouldn't have been possible without the support of our Patreon members. Many thanks to our science producers, Salma Ahmed, Carly Van Orstel, Janine Cuevas, Samantha Ancona Esselman, and David Cabral. If you'd like to support us by donating as well, you can head over to patreon.com/carrytheone. We have Patreon rewards at every support level, and we're grateful for any amount of support. You can also share our podcasts with everyone you know and leave us a review. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and start a conversation. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll share more stories next time.